Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, author and lawyer Richard Herman, believes immigration is the key to unleashing a new era of American prosperity. Herman runs an immigration specialty law practice in Cleveland, Ohio, a declining Rust Belt city which he says has been recently transformed by the creative energies and hard work of its immigrant population. It's a story Herman sees repeated nationwide as immigrant entrepreneurs bring new ideas and new vitality to every sector of our economy. Herman's book, Immigrant Inc., cites dozens of statistics to back up his theory. For example, he says immigrants are almost twice as likely as native-born Americans to start a business, and that newcomers have also founded more than half of the high-tech firms in Silicon Valley. But this success is threatened, Herman says, by an immigration system he calls a dinosaur, putting up unwelcome signs to outsiders, which he says will lead us to fall behind in the global economy. Today in The Exchange, we continue our look at immigration and the economy with Richard Herman and his perspective on this issue. Herman will be the keynote speaker in New Hampshire this weekend at the Granite State's first Immigration Integration Conference at St. Anselm College. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now with your thoughts. Do you see the economic benefits of immigration that Richard Herman sees? Or do you think opening the doors to more immigrants would hurt our economy, causing people already here to compete harder for jobs? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Richard Herman joins us from Cleveland. And Richard Herman, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've called America's immigrant entrepreneurs our, quote, secret weapon. What do you mean by that, Richard?
Well, in my view, they're the X factor. They're the secret sauce that made America great from the beginning and can make us great for the next 100 years as we face competition from China and India and other countries. Attracting and welcoming hungry, hardworking, optimistic immigrants who believe in the American dream is a driver for American entrepreneurship. I mean, just look at our Fortune 500 companies today. 40% of them were either founded by an immigrant or a child of an immigrant. For example, Apple. Apple's, you know, Steve Jobs is a child of an immigrant from the Middle East. Google, PayPal, Yahoo, tons of these companies were founded by immigrants. And if you look at those 40% that I mentioned, the Fortune 500 companies, they employ over 4 million people worldwide and $10 trillion in revenue. So it's really the uniqueness of America in welcoming this many immigrants. And we're losing that now with this toxic debate that we're having that's somewhat, you know, it's founded on faulty data and research, and it's really repeating the old arguments that we heard in the early 1900s in this country, that immigrants are ruining this country.
Well, and we'll definitely get to some of those arguments this hour, but just a little bit more on this, you know, X factor, secret weapon idea. What's that all about? What's this culture of entrepreneurship that you write about in your book, Richard, and where does it come from?
Well, you know, so Ed Roberts, who started the MIT Entrepreneurship Center, was looking at the number of immigrants that were going through MIT and then founding their own companies. And he said that to immigrate is an entrepreneurial act. And for me, that really summed it up. I mean, immigrants are people that are almost like, you know, jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. They're risk takers by definition, and they're able to absorb a lot of, you know, hardship and stress and still maintain optimism. And those are the same characteristics you need to be an entrepreneur. You know, starting a company today is very, very tough, and actually in any era, whether you're setting up a small little restaurant in the corner or you're setting up a high-tech company, I mean, there are thousands of obstacles you're going to encounter in the life of that business. So I found that, you know, immigrants have that spirit to overcome that. They have that culture. I married an immigrant, actually. I married an immigrant from Taiwan, and we're raising our kids now. We have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I'm seeing that in her as we're raising our kids, this entrepreneurial spirit, this spirit of, you know, that we're going to educate our children, we're going to equip them to compete in a global environment. We want them to learn Chinese. We want them to seek out new adventure and create new things. So there's something special, I think, about the immigrant culture that that we get, and I think that translates into new businesses. you know, you mentioned in your opening that immigrants are twice as likely to open a business than American-born. That's not my research. That's the Kauffman Foundation research, which is the number one foundation in the country, a research facility that studies entrepreneurship. And they also said that, you know, they asked the question, you know, where do jobs come from in America? And this is really, if you watch the political discourse, this is the billion-dollar question, right? Where do jobs come from? Some people think they come from the White House, right? The president can sign a bill and we can spend money and we're going to create jobs. Some people think that big companies create jobs, you know, large, big, mega corporations. Some people think they fall from the sky, apparently. But the reality is they come from startups. So the Kauffman Foundation studied where, you know, the job creation. They found that 100% of all net job creation since 1985 in America come from startups. And they define that as any company that's less than 5 years old. So again, small little businesses, mom-and-pop shops, and even large, you know, technology companies.
So the characteristics, Richard, that it takes to become an entrepreneur, you know, a willingness to take risks,
right.
Energy and so forth, this is a self-selecting group. Anybody who's got the wherewithal and the drive to immigrate is going to have those characteristics which will help him or her start a business. I also wonder, though, do immigrants sometimes start businesses because, you know, when they come here, nobody's going to hire them, so they have to start their own business.
That's true. That's true. We see a lot of immigrants that have language barriers, you know, and they can't get hired easily in the American environment. Their credentials abroad don't translate here. So we see, you know, physicians, surgeons, engineers, lawyers, you know, working in manual labor, you know, and then hopefully maybe starting a company, just because they can't get hired in their profession. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of barriers that cause people to go into entrepreneurship. So it's a mixed factor. You know, why do immigrants, you know, gravitate towards entrepreneurship? But if you look at, you know, Silicon Valley and, you know, you mentioned 50% of the companies are foreign born. I mean, you know, what would we do if we don't welcome the refugee family of Sergey Brin? You know, Sergey Brin co-founded Google. And for the book, actually, I interviewed his parents. And they brought Sergey here to the country from the former Soviet Union when Sergey was six. And they did so because they knew he had no future in the Soviet Union. He was Jewish. He's Jewish. And on his papers, the word, on his birth certificate, the word Yevrei, which is Russian for Jewish, was there. And that would always be with him. And his parents actually were scientists. They wanted to be physicists, and the government wouldn't let them, and so they made them into economists. So they came to America because of Sergey. And so if we don't let that refugee family in to the United States, maybe the world doesn't get Google, or the world gets Google 30 years later, and it's invented in China or in
India.
Well,
that's a big what if, though, isn't it? I mean,
not really. I mean, if you look at Silicon Valley. I mean, look at all those companies there. 50% are foreign born, are founded. So, you know, I mean, you're right. You can't predict who is going to be an entrepreneur and who's going to hit it
big. At age six,
you can't do that. But what we know is these people have propensities to excel way beyond the average person, right? We know that.
And Richard, okay, so you got the book, and you've been talking about this around the country, the power of Immigrant Inc. and how it's going to help everybody. But polls on this issue suggest many Americans agree with the more anti-immigrant position that, you know, there was one by the New York Times a year or two ago that showed 74% of Americans think immigrants weaken our economy. So
Right. Not
a lot of folks are on board with what you're saying.
Well, we're just touching this on the surface right now. So, and we're putting all the immigration issues into one basket. So if I ask people on the street today, what do you think of when I say the word immigrant? You're going to hear things like they're taking our jobs, they're not learning English, they're bringing crime, they're stealing our health care, they're ruining America, okay? Which, by the way, is the same thing we said about the Jews and the Irish and the Germans when they were coming here 120 years ago or so. But the reality is, on the high-tech side, okay, let's just divide that for a moment. And by the way, our obsession with the low-skill immigration and undocumented immigration is paralyzing Congress to do anything on the high-skill immigration side, which is really where the huge job creation potential is. We're not passing legislation on the high-skill immigration side to fix those problems. A lot of our high-skill immigrants are actually leaving the United States right now or not coming at all because we're treating them so poorly. We're making them wait 8 years or 10 years for a green card and this sort of thing that they're leaving. So on the high skill side, I mean, just consider this. I mean, go into the graduate level programs in American universities in science and engineering and tell me what you see. What you'll see is two-thirds of the students are foreign-born. They're not American-born students. So our students, our American kids, are not going into science and engineering. If we want to be competitive in a 21st century global economy, which is going to be based on knowledge and high technology, if we want to be secure as a nation from a national security standpoint, if we want to be on the cutting edge of creating energies, new energy technologies, we got to have an engineering class here, right? So we're not growing our own. We need to do that. We need to find a way to do that. But in the meantime, we got to build the most powerful teams on the planet. And you know, we accept that with sports teams. We accept that with Major League Baseball and the NBA. You know, Major League Baseball is one-third foreign-born. You know, NBA is 20% foreign-born. Hockey is 80% foreign-born. Americans accept that because we want to win those games, even though American athletes are displaced. But when it comes to the economy, oh, it's a different story.
Well, it affects right. all of us personally, or at least we perceive that it does. I wonder, you know, this is an important point that we talked about Monday on the exchange, this skills gap that businesses talk about. And you said, yep, I hear it. We need to train and have more homegrown, you know, scientists and engineers.
Right.
Is the ability to bring in high-skilled immigrants giving businesses an excuse and the American education system an excuse not to make those investments?
No, I don't think so. You can't build a country on importing, welcoming immigrants. You can't do that alone. Okay, you got to have.
You have to train your people here.
You've got to train your own people. Immigration is not a substitute; it's a complement to our labor force. See, we've never had an economics-based discussion in America on immigration. It's always been politicized. We've never. Other countries have more of an economic-based discussion. For example, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, even the UK, they're having discussions now about how do we devise immigration that's based on filling needs in the labor market, right? And those labor market needs change very quickly. So what we have in America is a paralyzed, antiquated dinosaur system that was built in the 1960s that has no relation to the 21st century economy. And we, in Congress and the American people, refuse to, you know, change it to so it could fit our economic needs. So that if we have, for example, if all of a sudden we see that we need brain surgeons, you know, we should be able to say, well, okay, we're going to help train our own, but we're going to attract some more from overseas.
Okay, and more after a short break. We'll start taking your calls, too. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. And support also comes to us from the McLean Law Firm and its corporate law group, providing businesses with timely solutions and completed transactions online at mclane.com. And from Hospice at HCS, providing comfort, care, and support for people with advanced illness in southwestern New Hampshire, from offices in Keene, Peterborough, and Charlestown, hcsservices.org. More of our series, The Economics of Immigration, on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, Tax Fairness, The Buffett Rule, and the 2012 campaign. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly cloudy with some occasional sunshine statewide with a few scattered showers. Highs from upper 40s in the North Country, mid-50s for the rest of the state. Tonight, becoming partly cloudy, lows mid-20s from the White Mountains north, lower 30s in central and southern areas of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we continue our look at immigration and the economy with Richard Herman, who says immigration is a source of innovation and global competitiveness for our country. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Do you see this economic benefit that Richard Herman sees of more immigration boosting our overall economy? Or do you think opening the doors wider to immigrants might hurt people who are already here? Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Richard, before we go to our listeners, I did want to finish up this conversation about your differentiation between the high-skilled workers, the innovators, the entrepreneurs, the Silicon Valley startups.
Yep.
The vast majority of immigrants, as I understand, are low-skilled workers who are taking the jobs at the bottom of the rung. How do they fit into Immigrant Inc.?
Well, I'm not sure that's accurate. The discussion is focused on the undocumented immigrants, but we welcome 1 million immigrants a year legally into this country. The problem is that our system doesn't, according to Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, he says we discriminate against the highly skilled immigrants. Only 4 or 5% of the 1 million green cards are actually reserved for highly advanced degree immigrants or investor immigrants. So, but going back to your perception that, you know, most of these folks that we're talking about are the undocumented.
No, I'm not saying undocumented. I'm saying coming in for low-skilled jobs, legally or illegally.
Okay. Let's talk about that for a moment. First of all, the recent data that I read is that we have 3 million unfilled jobs in America today. So if you look at where immigrants fall in the workforce, they generally fall on the outer ends of a bell curve. They're usually at the lower skill levels or the very high skill levels. So Americans are generally in the middle. We tend not to want to do the back-breaking work of agriculture and that kind of stuff, and we tend not to go into science and engineering. So to keep the economy moving and humming along, we need to fill those slots. Interestingly enough, the Federal Reserve economist yesterday released data, I think out of Atlanta, national data on what was the negative impact. Was there a negative impact of having low-skilled immigrants in the United States? How much does it drive down U.S. wages? And they found that the negative impact on U.S. wages was less than was a little bit over 0.1%.
So they don't drive down wages for regular
basically
Americans.
Not. So what's all the fuss about? I mean, if this is the day, so you know, if you look at history and the historical arguments, we've always got it wrong on immigration. We eventually get it right. You know, we shouldn't scapegoat immigrants for economic problems. You know, immigrants did not cause this economic collapse. I argue they could be part of the solution. But the data on what immigrants bring to this country is overwhelmingly positive in the long term. Even the public benefits issues. People say, well, immigrants are getting all this public. You know, you can't get food stamps if you're just a new green card holder here in America, or if you're an undocumented immigrant. I mean, what we're talking about mostly is school funding and emergency health care. But over the long run, immigrants are a net benefit, even on the public benefit side. They contribute money in their sales tax receipts and in their payments for sales tax. Many of my clients who are undocumented pay taxes, income taxes. They get an IRS ITIN number, and they file taxes every year. By the way, if we legalize these folks, these 11 million undocumented, it will pump in $1.5 trillion to the U.S. economy.
How so?
Well, I mean, think about this. This is the population size of Ohio. If they're living in the shadows, they're in the dark. They're not able to legally drive. They're not able to legally work. But most of them are working. They're trying to raise a family. They're doing everything that many of us try to do every day. If we legalize them and give them social security numbers, what's the first thing they're going to do? They're going to start to buy. They're going to buy homes. They're going to buy cars. They're going to send their kids to college. They're going to do what Americans do. And that consumption, 70% of our economy is based on consumption, unfortunately. They're going to consume and drive the economy. They're going to drive up house prices. For example, I was just in Toronto a week ago, and a little bungalow in Toronto is $600,000. What's driving the real estate market in Toronto is the influx of immigrants. 50% of the population there is foreign-born. So Canada, Toronto, Vancouver, they welcome immigrants. We turn them away. In my hometown, Cleveland, which used to be the sixth largest city in America with 1 million people, we're down to now 395,000 people.
Wow, it's a big drop.
We lost more people than any other big city in America, except for Detroit and New Orleans, which had the hurricane. We lost 17% of the population in the last 10 years. So we have thousands of abandoned homes. And the conversation here now is, let's just bulldoze those abandoned homes and we'll grow corn. We'd rather raise corn than raise families and build the tax base and build a city again. So that's the discussion that I want to, this discussion for me is personal because it came from my city. I wanted to save my city. I saw the decline. I saw what was happening. And from my law practice, in my personal experience, I knew that immigrants were part of the solution and we kept pushing them away. And I think from the national standpoint, we got to get back to that Ronald Reagan ideology that, we're the shining city on the hill. We should be confident and welcome these newcomers. They're making us stronger.
Let's take some calls, Richard. And our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And waiting in Ashland is Walter. Hi, Walter. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
My point is, I know that back in the 90s, after I had come home from Iraq, I see a lot of legal immigrants. Legal immigrants, I believe, do help the economy. But they are easier at getting a loan for a startup company than a American born here in this country.
How do you see that, Walter?
I myself went and tried to apply for a loan for a small business. At the time, had good credit, but had no backing. And I see several in my town, Iraqis, that were came into town. And I'm not trying to say a specific immigrant, okay? I don't have anything against any immigrants, don't get me wrong. It was just these type of people that came into town and were able to get loans right off the top and open a store, you know? And to me, that just is wrong. And I was told by several people that it's easier for them to get a loan coming into the country than it is a person that's here because they don't have any debit at all when they come into the country. You understand what I mean?
Yeah. Walter, thanks for the call. You know, this is an interesting point. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I mean, and I appreciate the call, Walter. Thanks for calling. I think this kind of underlines the misinformation that's out there. I mean, Walter is relying on anecdotal evidence, you know, that immigrants are somehow getting loans easier than American born. I would argue the opposite, that it's much more difficult for someone who just newly arrived in this country to get a loan at a bank. They have no credit history, no asset history for many of them. No bank's going to just loan them money. What Walter may be mistaking for bank loans is actually internal credit or internal financing arrangements within immigrant communities themselves. For example, the Koreans are known for the revolving loan program within their communities, and Chinese and other groups in the Middle Eastern communities as well. They pull together and they finance themselves. You know, one family will come in and there'll be already 10 or 20 families already established, and they'll pull in $5,000 here, $5,000 there, and they'll loan that newcomer family money. So I wouldn't castigate that practice. I would celebrate it.
So you're saying that it's not necessarily that American banks give immigrants preferential treatment, but that groups of immigrants who are already here kind of pool together to help their own? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And have you seen that in the refugee community as well? Or is that a different situation?
Yes. I mean, they, you know, as the refugee families get more established and the businesses get more established, they do start to give back in new ways. I mean, it's true that refugees do get resettlement money when they first arrive, okay? But that, you know, you're not getting substantial loans to start businesses or anything like that. You're getting basically stipends to just, you know, get an apartment for 6 months and get your, you know, get your feet planted in America. After that, the monies dry up and you're on your own. Now, there are new programs starting, they're nonprofit-driven that are helping refugees and other new immigrants with small microloans and that kind of thing. But these are not, you know, your traditional immigrant walking to an American bank saying, I want $50,000 for a loan for a business, and they're getting it. I don't think too many banks will do that.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Walter, thanks for that call. Join us with your thoughts as we look at Richard Herman's ideas around Immigrant Inc. He says that immigrants can provide a huge measure of prosperity for our country, unleashing a wave of entrepreneurship and innovation. Do you agree with that idea, or are you concerned that opening the doors wider to immigrants could hurt our economy? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Richard Stevens up from Manchester. Hi, Stephen. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. One of the worst laws that I've noticed in this country is with regards to how our universities treat international students after graduation. In other words, when you have an international student who graduates, we now have a skilled scientist or an engineer that we don't grant citizenship to. Versus France, for example, once you graduate from a French university, you're guaranteed French citizenship.
Really? Instead, it's that actually, easy, Stephen? Really?
It's part of the system. They're trying to retain their skilled labor, which we're actually, kicking it out, essentially. The 4 years that you spend in university does not count towards your citizenship status. And that just flabbergasts me.
All right, Stephen. Well, thanks for the call. What do you think, Richard?
Well, thanks, Stephen, for the call. I think we're also mixing up the idea of worker visas and green cards and citizenship. People don't just jump from being a student to a citizen. It's a long, long road to becoming a citizen. But the caller is right. When the student graduates, let's say that someone graduates with a PhD from MIT, they're an international student. They're usually given 12 months of work authorization to stay in the United States, and they may be eligible for an additional 17 months of work authorization as long as they work in the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering. But at some point, if they want to stay and continue working here, they've got to have a job that will sponsor them for what we call an H-1B visa, a professional worker visa. The problem is we only have 65,000 regular H-1Bs and 20,000 additional H-1Bs for advanced degree individuals from American universities. So 85,000 basically each year, each fiscal year. Well, in previous years, not in this last two-year recession, almost all of those visas were gone in day one when the fiscal year opened. So 115,000 applications were filed on day one for 85,000 visas. So, you know, so a lot of young talent didn't get the visa. And guess what? They may have to go back home, you know, and that's what's happening. And so that's one problem. And the caller identifies. The other problem is, let's say they get the H-1B visa and they say, you know what, I like America and I want to stay here. Maybe I want to start my own business and raise my family here. Well, they got to get a green card to do that. Well, the green card system is so screwed up. We have nationality quotas, for example, so that no country can get more than 7% of our employment-based green cards, you know, getting a green card through a job. Regardless of the skill level. Well, right. And so Norway, which has 5 million people, has allocated the same number of green cards as India, which is over a billion. So this is why we're seeing Indians and Chinese with advanced degrees saying, you know what, I'm not going to wait 8 years for my green card in America anymore. In the old days, they would suck it up and say, there's not much going on back home. I got to stay here. But now they're saying, you know what, the economy's popping in India. The economy's popping in China. Or even worse, other countries are coming on the U.S. soil, recruiting our disgruntled high-skilled workers. Canada is coming on here on our soil and saying, you know, why do you suffer this humiliation? The Americans don't want you. They don't believe that talent is the new oil. Drill, baby, drill. We do. We want talent. Come to Canada. We'll give you a green card in 6 months. We'll give you citizenship in 3 years. So this is how cities like Toronto and Vancouver went from being, you know, small little quiet cities to global meccas. They attracted talent.
This relates to our earlier conversation, Richard, about the H-1B visas and, you know, whether businesses are snapping up people with H-1B visas instead of investing in the training. And I'm looking at the education system, too. I'm not just blaming businesses. You know, and this comes up a lot, that we need these people to fill the skills gap. But the Census Bureau's 2010 American Community Survey shows there are 100,000 U.S.-born individuals with an engineering degree who are unemployed. Mm-hmm. An additional 243,000 Americans under age 65 who have an engineering degree but aren't even in the labor market. So what about those people? It looks like there are tens of thousands of unemployed Americans with engineering degrees who could be hired. Why do we need to bring in H-1B visas?
But your question implies all engineers are equal, all created equal, and that's not true. You know, you have different skill levels and different specialties within engineering and computer programming in these sort of areas. And the labor market is constantly changing, so the labor needs are constantly changing. The skill level sets are constantly changing, you know. So, you know, I traveled around the country talking on behalf of with the Partnership for New American Economy initiative started by Mayor Bloomberg and Rupert Murdoch in a coalition of 500 major CEOs and mayors around the country. We do these events around the country with chambers of commerce, and actually there'll be some representatives from the partnership in New Hampshire on Saturday. You know, and we hear from employers over and over and over again, we cannot find the skill set within the U.S. labor market that we need. We would gladly hire the skill set if we can hire. We don't want to pay lawyers and you know, immigration lawyers thousands of dollars, pay the government thousands of dollars in filing fees, and go through this, you know, excruciating process for H-1Bs and green cards. I mean, you know, it's a Kafka-esque maze, even for me, and that's what I do for a living. And these employers don't want to do that. They would prefer to hire American-born, but they have to go this other route if they can't find the talent locally. And it gets worse. What they're saying is, we're going to go, you know, that's why we're opening up overseas, many cases, for R&D. We're not there because of low wages. We want to access brain power. And if I was building a case against America's commitment to innovation, Exhibit A in my case would be what Bill Gates did 3 years ago in Vancouver. He opened up R&D in Vancouver. And his press release said, we did it because we believe brain power should be in the same room so they can innovate and inspire each other. And America won't let us do that. America will not let us attract the world's best and brightest to be in America. So we're going to set up in Vancouver so our Seattle American team can go over the border and be in the same room with the world's best brain power. That, you know, there's no excuse for that. And now there's even a business idea being proposed in the tech magazines, being written about. That there's a guy out in California. It's setting up a company that will be a ship, a ship floating off the coast of California, international waters, where companies can locate and hire, you know, the world's best
whoever
brain power,
they want without
whoever
dealing
they
with...
want without visa restrictions.
You're you know, kidding, right?
I'm
really?
Not kidding. No, yes. And there's funders looking at investing in that company. This is crazy. I mean, I wrote the high-skill immigration policy for the Great Lakes Chambers of Commerce, 30 chambers from Chicago to Pittsburgh. And one of the things we proposed was, listen, you know, if America doesn't want these high-skill workers, how about letting us dying cities like Cleveland or Detroit, let's create some zones, some high-skill immigration zones where companies can come here and be free of these business-crushing visa restrictions. Let them, instead of Bill Gates opening up R&D in Vancouver or China, let them come to Cleveland. We'll take them, you know, and then the 30 chambers. We've been lobbying Congress on this, and of course, anytime you mention the word immigration, whether it's PhDs or legalization, you know, Congress just shuts down.
Well, and there's fears after 9/11 and so forth, and I want to address those in a minute with you, mm-hmm. Richard. But let me also bring in an email from Greg, who says, "Why during this entire week's discussion, and especially today, do both host and guests refuse to make the distinction between legal and illegal immigration? The negative attitudes your guest is quoting refer to illegal immigrants for the most part." Greg, thanks for chiming in. What do you think? Do the negative attitudes only apply to illegal?
No.
What do you think?
No. Some of the biggest groups out there, like FAIR and Numbers USA, these are anti-immigrant groups out there. They propose not only steps to do mass deportation, which would probably require internment camps in America, against 11 million undocumented immigrants and their families, including U.S. children that are in there. But they also want to restrict and decrease legal immigration. I mean, I think, you know, I think America is really going through some gut-wrenching economic restructuring, and we're also experiencing a major demographic transformation. I mean, if you look at the American demographics today and where it was 30 or 40 years ago, it's a much different America. America 20 or 10 years from now will be a much different America. You know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, when will the minority population be the majority in America? And that date keeps coming sooner and sooner and sooner. It used to be 2050, then it was 2045, now it's 2042. You know, I think there's some discomfort in America about this issue. I mean, the undocumented issue for me is not that criminal. Under the law, it is not. We don't see criminal prosecutions of undocumented immigration.
Okay, Richard, I got to cut you off there.
It's a civil
violation. I do apologize. We have to go to a short break, but we'll be right back.
Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, doesn't shy away from the big questions.
So does America need to produce more scientists and engineers?
Okay, let's talk about
signs of an early spring, that we humans have more in common with gorillas than we think.
And where does the dark energy live?
I'm Brady Carlson. Join me as I sit down with Ira to discuss scientific questions of all kinds. We'll be at UNH Durham on May 1st. For tickets and information, visit nhpr.org.
This event sponsored in part by NEBCO and the University of New Hampshire.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Grupponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at Grupponi.com. And Farnham Hill Ciders, real ciders, orchard-made at Poverty Lane Orchards from True Cider Apples for spring festivities and dining enjoyment. Store locations online at PovertyLaneOrchards.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our final look at immigration and the economy, focusing in on New Hampshire. Email us your thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, our guest is Richard Herman, co-author of the book Immigrant Inc., Why Immigrant Entrepreneurs Are Driving the New Economy and How They Will Save the American Workers. Let's get your thoughts in on this topic. Do you see this benefit that Richard Herman sees of more immigration, or does the idea of opening America's doors wider concern you, especially economically? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Richard, let's go back to our listeners. Henry's in Concord. Hi, Henry. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think if you grant amnesty to the illegal immigrants, it would have done the economy good. Because just for the fee that they have to pay, it's like $500 or $600 and something. I'm thinking about 11, 12 million illegal people that are living here. It would have helped the economy just for paperwork alone.
So, Henry, giving amnesty to illegal immigrants, a big economic boost. And you touched on that earlier, Richard Herman, but go ahead.
Well, you know, George Bush, was a big proponent of a law that we used to have called the Life Act, which basically said, hey, if you're here undocumented, whether you came here without a visa or you overstayed, you came on a visa but overstayed, you know what? You committed a civil violation. It's not a criminal violation that we're going to prosecute, but civil violation. And that's not right. You know, but you can make up for it if there's someone who will sponsor you for a green card, either a family member or an employer, and you pay a financial penalty. Back then it was $1,000. So my question now to America is, let's make them pay. What penalty is high enough? You know, let's make them pay $2,000 or $3,000 penalty and have them file green. Make them go through background security checks. Let's bring these people out of the shadows. It's not safe to have 11 million people running around our country without ID. I mean, ask law enforcement how comfortable they are pulling over people on the road when the person doesn't have any ID. They don't know who that person is, what crimes they may have committed. They have no way of tracking them, you know, at the street stop. So I agree with the caller. I think legalization is the way to go. I mean, Congress seems to think, and Romney seems to think, that self-deportation is the answer. These people will just leave voluntarily. I can tell you, they're not leaving. They've been here 10 years. They've got kids that are born in the United States. They've got kids going to high school and going to college. Let's get real about this, and let's be realistic and pass some law to fix it, and let's jumpstart the economy.
Well, and you mentioned Governor Romney's position on immigration, generally seen as taking a hard line on immigration. I have heard also, though, that President Obama has been talking about all the deportations that have happened under his watch. How do you perceive his approach toward immigration?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. He campaigned tackling immigration reform as a first order of business. He didn't do that. He blames the Republicans, there's a lot of blame on the Republican side. We've moved away from the Reagan-esque and Bush policies on immigration. At the same time, you're right. Obama has deported more people than his predecessor. And I would say with a ruthlessness, he's separating families left and right. He thinks it's strategically important, I believe, to show America that we respect, you know, the law, and we should. But he's doing it without compassion. He has the authority, his own lawyers say, from the Immigration Service, to pass administrative reforms to at least temporarily alleviate some of this pain, and to legalize these people at least temporarily until Congress will address this issue. Because right now, because the president's not taking action to address this problem, states and cities around the country are passing their own immigration laws, which is not even constitutional.
Alabama, Arizona, matter. And so forth.
It's a federal matter. And we're spending law enforcement dollars and money on busting busboys. We should be busting drug lords. You know, I mean, let's get our priorities straight. I mean, who's the enemy here?
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. And Henry, thanks for that call. You can join us 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And here's an email from Bernadette Richard in Laconia, who talks about illegal immigrants. She says we need to get employers who have hired illegals for fruit and veggie picking, landscaping, menial jobs, no benefits, horrible living conditions, and continue to hide these workers under the radar. We have to stop being blind to this very real fact of life. She has another point, though, too. She says, if the employers and corporations are telling us they cannot find people with certain skill sets, then that goes back to the education that our children are receiving from kindergarten through college and graduate programs. Why do you think, Richard, that people from India, Pakistan, China do flock to these fields more than Americans, to the point where employers say we can't find the people? Is it that there's something wrong with us Americans, or is it our education system?
Well, you talk about the fields in science and engineering, not the fields where tomatoes are grown, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, I don't know if it's something wrong. I mean, you know, my dad was an engineer, and he told me, he says, you know, I don't want to get my PhD because I don't see it as a good investment. You know, I'm not gonna get the return on my time and get the return on my capital. So you know, I think a lot of us say, well, you know, I might as well get my MBA and make a lot of money in financial engineering as opposed to going into engineering and making a little bit of money. Does immigrant influx drive down wages in engineering? The data doesn't support that. Actually, the data supports growing the pie. So I think we think of the labor market. By the way, I'm no economist. I'm just a simple guy in Cleveland, Ohio, okay, who loves this issue. But the data supports the idea that, you know, that it's not a zero-sum game with jobs. We can grow jobs. You know, we can grow the economy. So the more talent you add, the more innovation you add, the more products and ideas you have. I mean, let's look at the export market, for example. The president says, I want to double the exports in 5 years. Why? Because exports is where the money's at right now. I mean, we can export products and ideas around the world. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, says that 87% of the world's growth in the next 5 years will be outside the United States. So how do we export to China, to India, to Brazil, to Africa, when we don't know those cultures, we don't know those languages and those environments? Well, we do that in partnership with immigrants. And that's one study out of Europe that actually shows that. The increase of the immigrant population actually correlates with an increase of exports to the home country. So we can grow this economy and create jobs. We shouldn't be fearful about losing one job here, one job there. We should be thinking about growing the pie.
You know, we talked with Mark Krikorian yesterday, Richard, mm-hmm. who, again, is a strong advocate of shutting down a lot of immigration. And he addressed this issue of, does it make the workforce bigger, the economy bigger? He said, look, is the policy goal to make the economy overall bigger, or is the policy goal to improve the quality of life for people who are already here, again, through good wages, good benefits, which he argues immigration knocks down, that it lowers wages, depresses wages, and depresses working conditions. So it's not the size of your economy, but it's the quality of life of the individuals living in that economy.
Well, that's true. But in a global economy, you got to be big, bad, and strong. I mean, China is roaring. I was just in China a couple of months ago, and you know the development there, the high speed rails and the infrastructure development, and you know it's phenomenal. I mean, it makes American sleepy cities look comatose compared to what's happening over there in other parts of the world. So, you know, we're not competing with cities down the road anymore, you know, or states around the country. We're competing globally. So we've got to think about building the most powerful teams on the planet, and just like our sports teams do. And I agree, it doesn't mean you got to be a billion people. But many folks think that we're going to have 400 million people in this country in the next 20 or 30 years, and I agree with that. So let's move with where the trends are going. Let's move with the future and not fight it.
Let's take another call, and this is John in Barnard. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, hello there. First off, your last comment about competing locally. This country has always been competing globally. I think there needs to be a line drawn on the immigration. I've been seeing an immigration problem in this country since the 70s, and it's been ignored up until now because it's gotten so out of hand. And I don't believe that you cannot find the experience in this country first. I mean, we're supposed to be the greatest country on earth. And I think it's an excuse because it all boils down to money. And we need to draw a line. If we don't draw a line, this country is going to be so overwhelmed, I think it's going to be too late to recover.
And when you
That's
say, John,
my opinion.
It's, John, can I ask you a quick question? When you say, I
sure.
think it's all about the money, what do you mean about that?
It's always about money. It's always about making more money, more money, more money. I don't believe it's so much about the technology than it is about making the money.
So businesses can hire immigrants and pay them less? Is that what you mean?
Yes and no. When you're dealing with giant companies, that's usually a little harder to do than if you're dealing with a landscaper. But nevertheless, it's the bigger companies want to make more money. And it's always about the money.
Okay.
And I think we need to draw a line in this country sooner. Yes, we're all from somewhere else, but it needs to be slowed down.
John, thanks a lot for joining us. Lots of thoughts there. What do you think, Richard?
Well, yeah, exactly. Lots of thoughts. Hard to parse out what to respond to.
Well, first,
to.
The idea that, you know, businesses are driving this push because, again, they want to pay people less. They want young, hungry immigrants who will, you know, work for next to nothing
level. Right. So let's just look at some of the agricultural industries in state laws like in Alabama or Georgia, which pushed out a lot of the undocumented immigrants. You know, the farmers there are saying they can't find American workers to come into the fields. Even if they raise wages, they're saying they can't find workers. I mean, I'd like to know if that caller would be willing to go work, you know, 40, 50 hours in the hot sun, you know, picking tomatoes or whatever. You know, I'd like to know, does your caller have, you know, advanced degree in science or engineering to fill those jobs in the high skill sector? So, you know, we can argue emotion, which I think the caller was relying on mostly, or we can look at the data in the global economy and what other countries are doing to attract and retain talent and build talent within. Don't get me wrong. We've got to build our own force. And we can't, you know, again, immigration is not a substitute, but it's a complement to our native-born workforce. So your caller also mentioned that we've always been competing globally. At a multinational corporate level, that's true. For small businesses and medium-sized businesses in America, we've not been very globally engaged. For example, the number of small and medium-sized enterprises in America that export is only 1%. It's minuscule. And that makes sense. A lot of companies did not have to, you know, go abroad and go into different markets around the world. They couldn't afford to. They were scared to do it. They could sell in the United States and do well, but now they got to sell overseas. And that's where I say, you know, we got to have a global vision of the world and a global vision of our country, and immigrants can help with that.
You know, our guest yesterday said that when farmers did mechanize, did raise wages, they found that they could compete and that the lettuce, you know, wasn't rotting in the field, so to speak. That farmers will complain about losing lower cost immigrant labor, but eventually they figure out how to make it work.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, mechanization always helps. I mean, you know, we do destroy jobs by increased efficiencies. You know, big companies destroy 1 million jobs a year through increased efficiencies and productivities and outsourcing and that sort of thing. So I think the agriculture industry can do that. But, you know, you can't eliminate hard labor from some of these industries completely. You can't do it. Someone's got to be there and be part of that process.
Making sure the fruit doesn't get banged up so nobody will buy it at the grocery store. You know, Richard, so we've talked a lot about the high-skilled workers who've provided so much innovation, you say, and we've talked somewhat about the lower-skilled workers. So is the answer a two-tier immigration policy, you know, more visas for the highly educated, highly skilled, and keep the lower-skilled where they are? Or is the answer opening the doors wider to everybody or what?
I think the answer is high fences, wide gates. And that's a phrase that polled very well by Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and strategist who came up with the idea, that phrase, death tax. He said that phrase polled very well. And basically, you know, Americans are comfortable with the idea that, you know, we have these skill shortages in America, and we need immigrants to fill those shortages. But we also have this sense of, you know, we're scared, you know, and we're scared about still 9/11 issues and violence from abroad coming into this country. And we do want to have a secure border. I want to have a secure border. In a post 9/11 world, I don't want people just coming over the border uninspected. Okay, so you know, so I think, you know, having that high gate, but is important. But having the door wide enough for those who have the skills that we want to be allowed in. So, the bottom line is, you know, we have to look at labor economics. Where are the shortages? Let's have a system that can respond to it quickly and say we need nurses now. Boom. And then when we don't need nurses, we shut it down. We've never had a system like that. Our bureaucracy doesn't work that way. You know, and on the startup side, again, I want to go back to where do jobs come from in America? Big companies destroy 3 million jobs a year in this 1 million jobs a year in the country. Small startups create 3 million jobs a year in America. Okay, and it's not just high tech companies; it's mom and pop shops in the Hispanic community. For example, there's 2.8 million Hispanic owned businesses in America with $400 billion in revenue per year. You know, employing over 2 million people. They're all over America. You know, so let's leverage that. I mean, if the data said that the people behind the startups have, you know, green hair and they wear funny tennis shoes and they live in the Bronx, you know, then you know what? Our resource, we would say, well, let's support them, let's welcome them, let's embrace them, right? Well, it's not them. It's immigrants are driving a lot of job creation. And by the way, not just immigrants, American-born are doing it too. And the real powerful secret that people don't talk about is when the immigrants and the American-born partner up. That's actually the secret sauce of Silicon Valley. Those companies that we're talking about, they're not just founded by one immigrant. They're founded usually by teams of an immigrant and American-born, bringing different skills, different talents together and creating something beautiful and powerful.
Well, and we've just got a little bit of time left. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Richard, but you're coming to New Hampshire this weekend, giving
yes.
a talk. If you want more information, nhpr.org. As you know, New Hampshire is not an immigrant-heavy state like Texas
right.
or Arizona. So is your message different here?
Well, I think it is. It's not too different from my state of Ohio. Not a rich immigrants state. Although we have more ethnic diversity within the African American community, Puerto Rican community, than probably New Hampshire. Still, I think the message of states like ours is, you know, building the economies of the future will require diverse people and diverse talents. You know, and the studies show that when you have people of diverse backgrounds, usually innovation happens quicker and faster.
All right.
Well,
Richard,
so that's the future.
I got to let you go now, and I thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Laura. Take care now.
That's Richard Herman. Again, he's an immigration lawyer, co-author of the book Immigrant Inc., Why Immigrant Entrepreneurs Are Driving the New Economy. Again, he'll be speaking at New Hampshire's first Immigrant Integration Conference on Saturday at St. Anselm College. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our series on New Hampshire's immigration story is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.